When you walk onto the magnificent campus of Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're enchanted by the Beaux-Arts architecture of Henry Hornbostel. The university is over 100 years old, and the buildings are as glorious as when they were first built. The university has thrived and become one of the top five engineering schools in the world, but the Fine Arts Building needs a basic upgrade. Plans for a music hall big enough for a symphony orchestra keep getting put aside as other ventures grow. They get new buildings and they acquire the real estate that is so precious on the campus. Today, I talked to Ricardo Schultz, the director of recording activities at CMU, who's also recorded in almost every hall in Pittsburgh. Almost. We take a trip to all the halls, virtually that is, and talk about the acoustics, aesthetics, architecture, and the beauty. Welcome back to Accelerando. My name is Paula Tuttle, and today we're talking about Henry Hornbostel, Andrew Carnegie, and the Carnegie Mellon University campus. It was Roy Hunt, the son of Alcoa's founder, Alfred Hunt, who donated the library at Carnegie Mellon University in 1961. The architecture features aluminum prominently, which makes sense. It's not as beautiful as the buildings by Henry Hornbostel that give the campus its style, which is Beaux-Arts. No, the library is kind of brutal, but fortunately the style of metal and glass has come into fashion in the 21st century. And of late, some colored footlights make the building look like it was all done on purpose. One thing Roy Hunt did do to preserve the campus's aesthetic, his gift mandated the university preserve the grass space in the center of the main campus, the cut, and buildings were never to be built on it. Ever since the 1980s, when the computer and AI departments took off due to a U.S. defense grant, the campus has been eyeing every inch to build new halls. Indeed, the campus has nearly doubled since then. Originally, Pitt and CMU were meant to be linked, and they nearly are. Their campuses are adjacent. Carnegie wanted CMU to be a technical school, a vocational school, a secondary level place for training of workmen, and for women, a school of domestic science. It was actually Hornbostel who convinced Carnegie to include the arts in his new college. The CFA was originally called the School of Design. So Carnegie gave over to Hornbostel, and the College of Fine Arts was placed at the center of the campus and slightly elevated on the lawn. It's evident the architect put his very best work into the Fine Arts Building, recreating Baroque statues and artifacts from Toulon and Versailles in the main hall. There's paintings on the vaulted ceilings that are derived from St. Peter's in Rome, plus an inlaid marble floor at the entrance from Michelangelo's plan for St. Peter's Basilica. Columns in the sculpture studios imitate the cloisters of St. John in Rome. There's so many artifacts in this building, it's just a beauty to behold. On the exterior, there are portraits of great artists in the terracotta. You see Beethoven and Shakespeare side by side. And there are four large niches in the front of the building that were only finally carved in the 1980s. They exemplify medieval, Greek, Roman, Renaissance, and non-European architecture. And then Hornbostel depicts himself as Bacchus on the exterior of the entrance. As so many artists will do, some of the fun facts is that in certain periods, artists will put themselves into allegorical paintings, and it's a game you can play in museums trying to spot those artist imposters. When you walk in the front of the CFA, after seeing the beautiful hallway, there are two performance halls on either side of the entrance. On the left is a music performance and architecture exhibition hall. It was actually first called Exhibition Hall, and now it's called Alumni Concert Hall, or ACH. It has a stage, but the room is best utilized for orchestra rehearsals by removing all the seats, and the stage is only really large enough for a piano and chamber music. So on the right side of the main hall is the Kresge Theater, which was originally called Carnegie Theater. It was a Versailles-inspired oval room out of oak and painted murals. Originally, it had a painted classical curtain as well as the murals on the theater walls. And there was a glass skylit ceiling that's now gone. But the proscenium still says in Latin, "Here inspiration unfolds its wings." Until 2000, it was mainly used by the drama department, but it was also used as a lecture hall, as it was on December 28, 1934, when the famous physicist Albert Einstein talked to students about his theory of relativity. And it's nice that some of the legacy has been preserved in the backstage area, where tech crews over the decades have painted their names. There's also a network of dressing rooms, stairways, and green rooms that have fallen into misuse, but nothing to stop you from exploring. They have never been renovated. In general, the building has a myriad of tunnels, crevices, niches, and underground rooms that keep the memory of the First World War alive. Indeed, when Barack Obama came to campaign during his re-election, the building served as both a practical venue and a nightmare for the Secret Service. Classes were canceled for a day so they could sweep through the many back ways and connecting rooms to ensure no one was laying in wait. The back door and loading dock to the Kresge Theater served as a perfect entrance for the motorcade. The hall was his green room, and the priceless 9-foot Steinway on the stage served as a table for his water bottle. I know this because I was teaching there the next morning, and I found the water bottle, which I discarded, but I kept the cocktail napkin with the presidential seal. At least they used a paper napkin on the Steinway. Obama spoke on the cut just outside the CFA, and Hornbostel, disguised as Bacchus above the entranceway, looked down over the president and the crowd. So in 2000, the drama department moved to the Purnell Center for the Arts, and they got a brand new theater, the Philip Chosky Theater, and it seats 450. So the music department can now use the Kresge Theater whenever it needs. And in the last year, the music department was given the GSIA building, or half of it, to use for their studios and classrooms. But there's still no hall big enough for a symphony orchestra. CMU uses Carnegie Music Hall in Oakland and sometimes Soldiers and Sailors for symphony concerts. But there are a lot of logistical problems, and I'll talk about them with Ricardo in just a few moments. It's the thing holding back the department, otherwise thriving from an infusion of great artists past and present, like Andres Cardenas, Jeannie Backstresser, Julius Baker, Forrest Stanley, great players in the Pittsburgh Symphony, a vocal and opera department, a thriving list of alumni, and an amazing building that is both inspirational and eclectic. What else do you need? Money, influence, and people willing to push for the real estate on the campus. The campus is small, not much different than Harvard and Cambridge, Mass., and it's been stretching out onto Forbes Avenue for decades. But there is enough for a symphony hall in close proximity to the CFA. 1,000 seats would be perfect. Carnegie Mellon University College of Fine Arts is a place where so many careers of so many actors, architects, musicians, and painters were nurtured, including Andy Warhol, Josh Groban, Stephen Baccio, and a long list of many more. We have Ricardo Schultz with us today. Welcome, Ricardo, and thanks for joining us. We've worked in a lot of different capacities over the years, haven't we? At the Bannatyne, Heinz Hall, all of the CMU venues, Kresge Theater, Mellon Institute, Carnegie Music Hall in Oakland, probably Soldiers and Sailors as well. I know you've mastered the opera recordings at the now Bits Opera Factory. So let's start with an overview of some of the halls. How do you rate them on a scale from 1 to 100, starting with Heinz Hall?
Heinz Hall, I love Heinz Hall, at least if I'm sitting in my preferred seat, which is in the top balcony, which I think they call the gallery. It also happens to be the cheapest seats of the house. And I would rate Heinz Hall around 99%.
Great. Yeah, it's a wonderful hall. And you've worked at the Benedum a lot too. You do all the operas over there, you master them after the fact.
Yes, I didn't actually record any of the operas in those few years that it was at Heinz Hall, but I have recorded every single opera since they moved to the Benedum, which is now more than 30 years, I guess, isn't it?
Yes, it is. 1987, so I guess we're coming up on something like 40 years.
Yikes. Yeah, that's possible.
That's a lot of operas. Yeah. Do you record at Heinz Hall as well?
No, that's a union house, and therefore you have to be in the union to do anything in Heinz Hall related to microphones or plugging anything in. But I do go there. Well, no, that's the Benedum. But at Heinz Hall, let me see. I have recorded one or two things there by special invitation, I guess you could say.
Right.
But I have taken the tapes from Heinz Hall for several years when I edited and mastered Pittsburgh Symphony recordings for the national radio broadcast.
So now you do an awful lot at CMU. How many recitals do you think you recorded just last spring?
There are well over 100 recitals a year at Carnegie Mellon. And when you add the ensembles, those concerts, there's Carnegie Mellon Philharmonic, there's a wind ensemble, contemporary ensemble, guitar ensemble, chorus, all of those things, they add up to dozens more of events. Now, I have to tell you that I used to do the teaching in the recording studio in the basement, and also the recording of all those ensembles and recitals. I used to run that operation. But I'm lucky that my colleague and good friend, Christian Chechko, is now running that operation. He's the head of recording services. And I spend most of my time teaching and doing special projects in the recording studio.
That sounds like a lot more fun. So let's talk about Presky Hall that's in CMU. It was originally called the Carnegie not Hall, but Carnegie Theater. And they used it with the drama department for a lot of years. And then this music department inherited it when they got another hall. So what do you think of the Kresge? I think it's got 250 seats or something.
Yeah, you're right. That was always a drama venue, School of Drama. And when they moved to their new building, we inherited that. It was empty for about a year or more because it needed so much renovation that we couldn't even use it for a while. I would rate Kresge as a small concert hall around 85%, maybe a little bit less, around 85, yeah. Again, I have my favorite seat there, but the shape of the hall is basically an ellipse. And it is a fairly not a wide ellipse, but the worst possible footprint you can have for a concert hall is a circle. The ellipse is an elongated or a shortened circle, squished at two ends. And that's what Kresge is. So it's not as bad as it would be if it were a circle, but it is an ellipse. And so the acoustics are not great. But again, it depends on what instrument or what ensemble you have there. It can be, you know, perfectly okay for small chamber music, or even large groups like a small orchestra, for example, wind ensemble. Those things can sound pretty good in Kresge.
Yeah, I think they do. When I think of a round hall that's not great, I think of the Frick Fine Arts. Do you know that hall?
I do. I know that very well because when I worked at Pitt, I recorded a lot of things there.
Yeah, what do you think of that hall?
You know, when I was recording in it, when I worked at Pitt, I thought it was pretty good. But then after some years of working in Kresge and other places, when I went back there, I thought it was not so good.
Right. It feels weird on the stage, I can tell you that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
so
pretty.
That is even, it is pretty. It's a very attractive hall, at least it was before they repainted it, I think.
Yeah, but it still has the clouds on the ceiling, I think.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
So that, I would say, a little bit less than 85, maybe 80% in terms of acoustic, you know, a scale of 1 to 100.
Well, you know, there's that exhibition, I call it exhibition hall, is actually ACH?
It never had set seats. There were always, chairs that you had to set up.
So I don't even know if you want to give a number to that one. What do you think of that hall?
You know, it records very well. And let me tell you the story of that hall. When I first got to Carnegie Mellon for the first, I don't know how many years, the acoustics and the look of that hall was so shabby, and the acoustics were so bad, it was almost impossible to do anything in that room. And over the years, before I got there, they had done all kinds of things like putting carpet on the floor. Then they put carpet on the walls. And they did so many things that to try to improve the sound. And this has to go back probably 15 years or so, they got money to do a renovation of the Alumni Concert Hall. And luckily, I was there to give some input and to show them what needed to be done. Maybe not how to do it, but what needed to be done. So at the time, we had these four big Yamaha speakers in each corner of the room. And I got a recording that we had made in the room and played it back through those speakers and cranked it up. And the sound was so deafening that people from all over the building came running in to say, "What are you doing? Turn that thing down." And the acoustic people who came in to listen, they understood what was wrong and they knew how to fix it. And they ripped all the carpet off the floor. Underneath was the original wooden floor, quite well damaged. They replaced the entire floor with the same herringbone pattern that was originally there. They got the blueprints for the original size and shape and configuration of the room and restored everything the way it had been at the beginning. What they said was, you, meaning us, the School of Music, could do anything we wanted from the waist up to the corners of the border of the ceiling that kind of curved down a little bit into the walls. The ceiling had to stay the way it was. The floor had to stay the way it was. And the wainscoting all around the room, which is solid oak, all had to stay the way it was too. That wainscoting all around of oak, they replaced that with new oak, but it looks beautiful. And the floor, of course, was this herringbone pattern that I mentioned. In between was where the acousticians could do whatever they wanted.
So on the walls, they put baffles and things like that.
Yes, there were things there that when they saw the budget, they told me, when they saw the budget, they said, "Oh, no, we thought it would be like 10 times that." You know, they were all set to do something really nice to it. But they came up with a way that met the budget and also worked. And I don't know if you remember, they have these like curved panels all over the place. Mm-hmm. And those panels slide onto a template, which gives them their curved shape. And those work to diffuse the sound so that it doesn't reflect it. It doesn't absorb it so much as it diffuses the sound and makes it good. One other thing is that we do have orchestra rehearsals there, and we had to make it clear to the acousticians that the room was usually used lengthwise rather than from the stage in the other side.
Facing the stage, it's hardly ever done that way.
Right. So the stage, if you have something going on the stage, it's okay. But they had to adjust the room so that it was used in the long way, meaning the conductor's back is to the long side of the rectangle.
Right. And they lowered that stage. You know, the stage used to be sort of shoulder height almost.
That was a later build. The original stage was exactly it's almost 12 inches, I think, very low to what it was. That was the original stage. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple reasons for that. First of all, we decided that it was better to go back to the original one. And the other thing was the ADA requirement.
Right.
You had to have a way to get from the floor of the Alumni Concert Hall onto the stage without going up steps. And if the stage stayed at the height that they made it, you know, some years later after the original one, the ramp would have to start in the hallway outside of Alumni Concert Hall.
Right, and then the actual entrance on the stairway wouldn't work either because there's all these steps in both directions.
Right. So you have to, the allowance for the height is 1 inch per foot. If that stage was 36 inches, you would need 36 feet of ramp to get
Right.
up to it. So we do have a little ramp there on both sides, and you can get up to the stage in a accessible way with a low stage. Originally, the same size as the original building.
And you know, right behind ACH is a room that's been used for lots of things, but I think it was originally a library.
That is now called the Studio for Creative Inquiry, and you're right, it was the Fine Arts Library in that big room behind ACH.
So a lot of changes have happened over the years, maybe not enough. There should be another hall. What do you think about having a hall on the campus that's big enough for a symphony orchestra?
That having a hall on campus for the School of Music and all the great ensembles that we have has been my fantasy dream forever.
Because the conservatory is, you know, reputable, has a lot of great teachers and a lot of great students, and they're always hauling down to Oakland, and then they have to pay rent, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so what do you think of that hall, the Carnegie Music Hall? Let's talk about that.
Carnegie Music Hall. In all the years that I've been at Carnegie Mellon, we did a lot of recording there with the orchestra. And luckily, the first years that I was at Carnegie Mellon, the orchestra actually had their rehearsals in Carnegie Music Hall. And that was a good way to experiment with microphones and microphone placement and to kind of learn the acoustics of the place. And I was very lucky that we had the time to do that during orchestra rehearsals. So I learned a lot about the hall and how to record to make it sound good. In some ways, it's a nice hall. Acoustics are not great. Sight lines, especially if you're in the open end of the big horseshoe, it's a horseshoe shape for the audience. And if you're at one of the ends of the open end of the horseshoe, you can't see the entire stage. A lot of it is blocked out. Looking down from the balcony in a concert situation, the double bass is all the way over on the right, and the violins all the way over on the left are sometimes in the dark. In other words, the lighting of the stage is not great. The acoustics are only, I would say, fair. So I would give it an 80 something, 85 maybe out of 100.
What
There's
about the
no.
shape of the room? You said horseshoe, and you said circles and ovals are bad. What's the shape of
It's
that?
it depends on where you sit. If you're up in the top balcony, it's not bad. It can certainly absorb the sound of a large orchestra. For chamber music, it's very important where you sit on the stage, because the acoustics can change whether you're further back on the stage or further forward into the hall.
And doesn't this stage slant?
It is. The stage is raked. And some people are very uncomfortable with that. I remember a concert with Denise Graves, and the pianist was very uncomfortable with that rake stage because the piano is tilted.
So raking, isn't that something you find more in like theater for plays or something?
It is, yeah.
It's not, was it really intended to be a concert hall if they
Well, I
rake the
think it
stage?
was actually because it's the original home of the Pittsburgh Symphony,
That's
and
right.
that's why Carnegie, donated it, because the Pittsburgh Symphony needed a new home or needed a home,
Right.
and that was their first home for many years. Richard Strauss conducted there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's some celebrity. So it was built in 1895. I
Something
believe.
like that, yeah.
And that was
And you know, there's also there the amenities that every concert hall has today are missing. I don't think it's air conditioned. There's no central place to put a mixer and do a live mix in the room. There's no recording booth or anything like that. So whenever we go there to record, we have to set up out in the hall, in the hallway, circling, really outside the concert hall, but in the like the pedestrian hallway.
And what about loading into that? You know, you have to come through that loading deck, and then there's these staircases. Is it weird getting in and out of the hall?
It is a bit. I mean, there is a loading dock there, but there's, if you have vans or trucks to load in there, that uses up just about all the parking spaces for people like the conductor and the recording engineer and so on. So parking for access to the loading dock is, a bit problematic. Those things we all put up with, though. We know that that's what it is, and we make adjustments. But there are few, if any, backstage rooms for the performers.
Yeah, there's like two, and it's all kind of linked, you
And
know.
there's no backstage bathrooms on the same floor as where the people have to wait to go on stage.
Right. Yeah, so it's got a lot of awkward things. It
It
doesn't
really
look
does.
updated. So he built that hall about 4 or 5 years after Carnegie Hall in New York. The one in New York I was seeing was designed by William Tuthill, strangely enough. And he was an amateur cellist. So I found something while looking that up today. I thought that was interesting. Carnegie wasn't so interested in music as he was in libraries. He was really interested in having free libraries, but he didn't think that music halls should be free. I wonder if today Carnegie would think that maybe Carnegie Mellon should have another hall.
Oh, I think he would, especially if he heard, for example, the Carnegie Mellon Wind Ensemble or the Carnegie Mellon Philharmonic. I think he would build a hall for these groups. I wanted to mention a couple other things. Let's see about Carnegie Music Hall in Pittsburgh. The lobby of Carnegie Music Hall in Pittsburgh is fantastic.
It's
I mean, that is
beautiful.
an architectural masterpiece, really. It is just amazing. And when they first built it, the lobby was an addition to the building. And they were trying to decide when they had the idea to put that lobby there, do they open up the hall and extend the hall to make it larger, or do they put the big lobby in? And they decided on the lobby. So, but that lobby is so
It's
beautiful.
amazing. It really makes the experience of going to a concert so much more elegant.
It is beautiful, and it's just I just love walking through there. I feel so great and so privileged to walk into that lobby. And Carnegie Hall in New York, they have a great concert hall. There's no question it's one of the great halls of the world. But we have the lobby.
We have the lobby. Yeah, in New York, there's three halls in Carnegie Hall, and the
Yes.
biggest one is Stern, and it
Right.
has 2,800 seats. And ours here, the Carnegie Hall in Pittsburgh, is 1,900. So,
So I want to mention one other hall that you didn't bring up.
yeah.
And this is the Carnegie Music Hall in Carnegie, PA,
Right.
just across the river. I don't know if you've ever played in that hall, but that hall has the most perfect acoustics of any place I've ever recorded in.
Really?
Yes, it's just fantastic.
So I was there once when they discovered a room above it that had been sealed for years, and they finally got it opened up, and there was a lot of stuff from the Civil War in there, and a lot of Civil War reenactors went to have a festival when they were opening it up, and I actually played some chamber music for the little opening ceremonies, and I thought that was really cool. Carnegie liked to have things above his halls. And the one in New York, he wanted to have some studios above it, you know, so he could rent them out and so that the hall would pay for itself. That was his thing. So I don't know what the purpose was of the one above the one in Carnegie.
Yeah, that room is off to the side. It's not exactly above, but it's up on the, let's say, the balcony level, but
Right.
off to one side, more, I think, above the library part. But I don't know if you know the story of that hall.
No.
Back in the late 1800s, when Carnegie, there were two communities side by side, with a different name, and they decided to amalgamate these two communities into a single town, and name it after Andrew Carnegie. So that's where the name Carnegie, the town, came from. And they invited Andrew Carnegie to the ceremony amalgamating these two towns in the hopes that he would give the town a steel mill. Instead, he gave them a library and a music hall.
How many jobs
You know what
were
happened
there?
to Steele? Yeah, you know what happened to Steele, right?
Right.
But that library and the concert hall are still there, and the concert hall is magnificent.
Okay, so getting back to the halls on the Carnegie Mellon campus, there's another hall we haven't talked about. I mean, there's a couple of, you know, assembly halls, but there's the one for the drama department that they got in 2000, isn't that right? The Chosky.
Yes. Right.
And there's a story about that, isn't there?
Yeah, originally when they were planning a new building for the School of Drama, they were also at the same time talking about a part of that space or a different space for the School of Music, because we were both, you know, bursting at the seams for what we needed to do. And at the last minute, they said, okay, this building's going to be only for drama, and the building for music will be phase two. And of course, phase two never happened. But the Chosky Theater and the School of Drama, the acoustics there are very dry. They certainly have good lighting. They have a good sound system. They have a dedicated booth for recording. And for music, it's not so good. And that's understandable. I mean, the acoustic needs of a theater are much different from the acoustic needs of a concert hall. We do our operas there. The School of Music does kind of borrow the space a couple times a year to put on operas in the Chosky Theater, and it works okay for that.
Yeah, it holds, what, 600, 400?
I'm not sure, really. More than Kresge. Sightlines are generally good.
When are we going to see the School of Music get a new venue? With there's so much stuff being built around the campus. I mean, I was amazed today after I was speaking to you. I drove out and that gymnasium went up so fast. My gosh.
Yeah. They tore it down and they're building a new building there, and that's going to be like a healthcare center for the campus.
It's huge already, you know.
It does look huge, yeah.
It just looks.
So I think it's got to be someone with a lot of money that says, here's the money, and this is what I want you to do with it.
Well, it's a great thing to put your name on, don't you think? Put your name on a performance venue?
It is. It is a great thing.
Yeah.
Carnegie Mellon is a great university. There's no question about it. And I think it has great things in computer science and engineering, in the fine arts, and I think especially, in my opinion, in music. And every great university has a concert hall on their campus. So this is the one thing I think that Carnegie Mellon University is missing.
Right. You know, when you think of the Eastman School of Music, and it has a huge auditorium, must be like 3,000, New England Conservatory, I'm thinking of things that were built around the same era, you know, New England Conservatory, mm-hmm. right about 1905 or something, same style. But the building does not hold a candle to the, you know, the CFA on the campus of CMU. The building is beautiful. Hornbostel went to great lengths to make that really special. And I think that he talked Carnegie into that building altogether. Like Carnegie wasn't really interested in making an arts department, so he called it the School of Design. But didn't they have music from the very beginning?
They did. The Alumni Concert Hall was split with the Architecture School, I think, because originally the Architecture School did their exhibitions there. It was called Exhibition Hall.
That's right, Exhibition Hall.
But they did have the practice rooms on the mezzanine level, and I guess some teaching studios there. I mean, the minute that the School of Music moved into that building, they were bursting at the seams. But I want to say one more thing about Andrew Carnegie. He did love music. And I don't know if you knew this or not, but he had in his home, he had installed a pipe organ. He hired a full-time organist to play the organ in his home.
Well, that's interesting. I always thought that he was more interested in libraries because when he was a young kid, there was a free library on the north side, what was called Allegheny back then, and he got the benefit of it. And then when he turned 17 and he was working for the Telegraph, he was told he had to pay for his book because the person that was running it retired. And that made him really angry. So he wrote a letter to the newspaper and he complained about it. And it got some change. You know, he made some change in the world. He got them to make it free again. And this became part of his mission on his life, to make free libraries.
So, it really did.
Yeah, so there's a statue over there on the north side of the gentleman that ran the library, Colonel James Anderson. They say he's the founder of free libraries in western Pennsylvania because mainly he inspired Carnegie to make it his mission. So Carnegie would attach music halls to them, even though he made great music halls.
There were several Carnegie libraries in the Pittsburgh area, and I think just about all of them have a performance venue built in. You know, the one in Carnegie, I think they told me that Enrico Caruso once gave a concert there.
Oh, that's great.
So they had big name people going to that hall. And of course, there's the other one in Homestead.
Homestead.
And that's a nice little concert hall too, similar to the one in Carnegie, PA, but the acoustics are not quite as good.
I have a program here of when Pablo Casals conducted two concerts in April of 1965, and he played all of the Brandenburg concertos in two concerts at Carnegie Music Hall in Pittsburgh. So an awful lot of great people have come through all of these halls.
Mm-hmm.
Albert Einstein was at Kresge in 1938. I remember President Obama came through. He used it for his green room before he spoke out on the cut.
I was there for that. I love that.
Hot day, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was hot. It was very hot. But it was such a great event. There was so much energy, so many people there. Everyone looked good. They were young and old and every demographic that you could imagine. And it just felt so good to be out there with Barack Obama talking to us.
Right, yeah.
One thing we didn't talk about was the churches that are used for concerts often. The churches in the East End I know are St. Paul's Cathedral in Oakland, Shadyside Presbyterian in Shadyside, Calvary Episcopal in the edge of Shadyside there, and East Liberty Presbyterian. These are all fabulous places. Calvary Church has fabulous acoustics. And then there's a smaller church, St. Andrew's, in, where is that? Highland Park, I guess.
Right.
Very nice church with a beautiful organ, and it's great for chamber music. Those acoustics and those spaces, it's just amazing to record in them. They look so good. Architecture is fantastic, and it just feels good to set up microphones there and to record stuff.
And Road of Shalom, there's some...
Oh, that's another place. They have two halls there. One is the big, almost an amphitheater, with a big dome ceiling, also designed, I think, by Hornbostel, isn't it? And that place supposedly is the largest unsupported dome ceiling in, I don't know, North America or something. And then they have the smaller concert hall, which is also very nice. I've done a lot of recording in that hall. I liked it a little bit better before they renovated it, but it's still a very useful space.
They have a beautiful piano in there. The piano's it actually moved from St. Andrew's to over there. I think it's owned by the Tuesday Musical Club. Is that right?
Oh, that could be.
There's another Frick, the one called the Pittsburgh Frick, has a little hall in there. It's hardly ever used. It's pretty small.
I was there the very first day that it opened, and there was a sweet old lady in a purple dress and tennis shoes that gave a nice little talk, and I wondered, who is that? It was Helen Clay Frick.
Oh my gosh. I was thinking of the piano that moved around. It was there, and then it went to St. Andrew's.
But that's a very nice little space there.
It is. Yeah. So we've covered a lot of venues, but there's more. There's Soldiers and Sailors.
Soldiers and Sailors is a huge place. I think it records very well. And I would say the acoustics there for a large orchestra, of course, it's good because the orchestra can make enough sound to fill the whole place. Smaller ensembles, maybe not so good because the place is so big. But it does record very well.
There's
And
maybe one other hall on the campus of CMU. It's in the University Center.
that is Meconomy.
Meconomy, yeah.
I don't like that hall very much. It's highly sloped, so the sight lines are pretty good, but I just find it uncomfortable for anything,
Right.
acoustically, I'm talking about now. The stage is kind of small. I don't think it was built for music.
Oh, and then there's Mellon Institute. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, boy, I have very mixed feelings about Mellon Institute. I don't like that place. It's noisy because there's the water supply for the heating system is in the walls on the left and right of that hall. So you often hear like a big hiss of air or something moving in that hall.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's no amenities at all. I mean, there's no backstage at all
No.
in Mellon Institute. So you walk off stage and I mean, that's it. There's just, a door and you're then out into the hall.
I always thought it was buried underground, so it had some kind of insulation. I thought it was a good
When,
place for recording because it was, surrounded by cement.
yeah, you would think, but it's so now we can, if there's a steady sound in a room of hiss or water piping through or whatever, we can always remove that later. We have the technology to do that now. But I just don't like the sound of it, of the hall. So it's a difficult place. One feature about Mellon Institute is we don't own that hall, so we have to follow somebody else's schedule if we want to put something in Mellon Institute. And actually, the same with the Carnegie Music Hall. If there's a wedding scheduled and we want to have a concert on that day, we can't do that. And the amount of setup, we have to take all of our music stands, chairs, harp, double basses, all the instruments and everything. And usually we'll have one rehearsal there. And if there's something going on between the day of the rehearsal and the day of the concert, we have to take everything back to campus and then go back again on the Saturday or the Sunday to set everything up again. Putting audio cameras for a video feed is a long haul chore. So it's not easy to work in that hall. So Synod Hall, it's basically behind St. Paul's Cathedral. Do you know
Right.
that hall at
I
all?
do.
It's not a bad little space.
I think Pittsburgh Concert Society did their concerts there for years. And so did Renaissance and Baroque.
Yes, and Chatham Baroque did concerts
Chatham
there.
Baroque, yeah.
And another one is the performance space at the seminary in East End.
That I don't know. I know where you mean, but I have never been there.
So Chatham Baroque just moved their offices to to the seminary
Oh,
building,
great.
and I guess they're going to put on a lot of their concerts in that space there. It's not bad. It's a very unusual looking space, but it really sounds quite good.
Yeah, and they're at you mentioned Calvary. They do a lot of performing at Calvary.
They do. There
There's
are
an
two halls there. One
yeah,
is
there's one
the main
upstairs, yeah.
church. I don't know if it's upstairs, but it's way down the hall in a different wing of the building.
There's a the choral room on it's upstairs and
Yes, I remember that. You're right. But there's yet another one.
there's yet another one.
Yes, it's in a different wing of the building. It's a very nice space.
Really? How could it be? I don't know of this. They have some pieces of artwork from, Italian churches and stuff in there, I think.
Have you been to St. Anthony's Chapel?
I know on Mount Troy,
Yeah.
I may have performed there once, but I didn't see the relic.
That place is known for having the largest collection of relics in the world, except for the Vatican.
Wow, that is really impressive. How did I
I had
miss the
one
relics?
interesting, yeah, I had one interesting experience there recording a choir. So we're recording the choir, and I'm looking at the score and recording everything. And all of a sudden, you know, they end the piece in this nice big chord. And I think the piece was in E flat. And I hear a high E flat. And I said, who's singing the high E flat? No one was singing it. It was just the accumulation of overtones that produced this note.
And that doesn't happen very often, does it?
No, it doesn't. And my comment to them was, the saints are with us.
Right, on E flat. Okay, I think we've covered an awful lot. You know, we didn't talk about the one on Ellsworth, the Unitarian Church, because there have been a lot of concerts there too.
There have been. And my comment there would be, you know, it's really hard to get bad acoustics in a church. And this is no exception. I think the acoustics are good in that church. It's an easy place to record. They may not be great the way Calvary or East Liberty Press is, but they're good.
They get a lot easy of sirens record. Going by, though.
You do.
Yeah.
St. Paul's is bad that way, too, because there's no isolation from the outside whatsoever. Oh, we forgot one other one. Hines Chapel.
Sometimes they have some concerts there. There was a recital series. I played there a number of times. But there's no piano, so you have to bring one.
Right, you have to bring one in, yeah. There's a lot of... the Hines Chapel Choir sings there, so I've recorded them many, many times in that space. The acoustics are good, as any church... There's a lot of noise from the heating system and the cooling system in that building.
Yeah.
So we always have to remove that later.
So have you recorded down at the Bits Opera Factory in the Strip?
You're talking about the Liberty Avenue Opera Venue.
Right. They have a rehearsal hall. It's in a big, you know, industrial, you know, kind of a setting, you know.
Yeah,
it looks very
I would
cool.
call that one of the biggest challenges to record in. Because they don't do it in the standard way of a stage, an orchestra pit, and an audience. So you just never know where the orchestra or ensemble is going to be. You don't know where the singers are going to be. And the last 2 years with the COVID restrictions, they did a lot of things in that building. So we really got to use every logistical thing we could to make it work in terms of the recording, because they all had to be broadcast on the radio.
Right. It always seems to work out. I guess you have to do your magic.
Oh, there's a lot to be done during and after. I think the first big one that we did there, everyone had to be socially distanced. And so the orchestra was actually in a different room. And the singers were in the main room. And we had to take, and we were in the second floor in yet another room. So I wasn't even in the venue at all to record that. And it took a lot of logistics.
Was that the Cosi Fan Tout that you're talking about? The first one they did?
That was the first one, yeah.
I actually played that one. I don't know what it was like out there. It was a strange thing to be in one room and the singers in another. And everybody wore masks, of course, even the singers.
Yeah. So. And Paula, I don't know how it worked out, but somehow the orchestra sounded great. The singers sounded great. How they heard each other and how they kept together, I have no idea. Of course, they have TV monitors, you know, for the singers and TV monitors and audio monitors for the conductor. But how they managed to pull that together, I have no idea. But it did work.
Maybe everybody knew the piece really well. You know, Anthony Walker did his magic, you know, up there on the podium. Another one that was, the Riley. Because when you were talking about how they keep changing the setup. And then there's the Byam, too.
The Byam. Yes, I've done a lot of recording at the Byam. It's not bad. And I must say that every time I've gone back to the Byam, it has sounded better. But most of the attention downtown for those theaters, all under the auspices of Pittsburgh Cultural Trust, the Byam is more or less the, you know, the stepchild, I guess. Mm-hmm. And all the attention goes to the other larger venues. But they've gradually been fixing it up, and it's not a bad space. I like the Byam.
I like it, too. It's got an awkward pit, but they did a lot of things to the backstage area. It's not too bad. The Riley, do you consider that a theater at all?
That is a theater, and I don't know that I've ever been in that place, and I certainly don't remember doing any recording there.
What about the Mozart room over in the Heinz Hall?
I have not recorded there at all.
Once the resident artists, before they were called the resident artists, I think, were up on top of a building in right in the middle of downtown Pittsburgh, and we played a concert in a little theater. It was right at the top.
Oh, I remember that place. What is that? Well, there is a performance venue in the William Penn Hotel all the way up at the top.
You mean the ballroom?
Yeah, the ballroom. But there's another one at a bank, I think.
It's a bank.
Is that possible?
Yeah, and it's a little recital hall on top of the bank. You haven't rated the Benedum yet.
For recording opera, I would say it's up there among the very best. But it is a beautiful hall, a great hall. I love it. Yes, if you're in the balcony of the Benedum, I think that's where the sound all comes together, from the orchestra pit and the singers on stage. That's where it all kind of blends perfectly.
I think we've covered all of the halls in Pittsburgh, except for the ones we missed.
Paula, it's been a great pleasure to reconnect with you, and I wish you all the best, and we'll talk again soon.
Well, thank you, Ricardo, for being here today. And thanks for your insight on all of the halls in Pittsburgh. Thanks to you, my listeners, for showing up today. Hope to see you next time. And next time you're on the campus of Carnegie Mellon University, do go into all of the halls. I think there are about 20 of them that have Henry Hornbostel's architecture. It truly is beautiful. Again, see you next time, and thanks for listening.